Bhishma Dev said, "Let me now invest my thinking, feeling, and willing, which were so long engaged in different subjects and occupational duties, in the all-powerful Lord Sri Krishna. He is always self-satisfied, but sometimes, being the leader of the devotees, he enjoys transcendental pleasure by descending on the material world, although from him only the material world is created." Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Because Bhishma Dev was a statesman, the head of the Kuru dynasty, a great general and a leader of Kshatriyas, his mind was strewn over so many subjects, and his thinking, feeling, and willing were engaged in different matters. Now, in order to achieve pure devotional service, he wanted to invest all powers of thinking, feeling, and willing entirely in the Supreme Being, Lord Krishna. He is described herein as the leader of the devotees and all-powerful. Although Lord Krishna is the original personality of Godhead, he himself descends on earth to bestow upon his pure devotees the boon of devotional service. He descends sometimes as Lord Krishna, as he is, and sometimes as Lord Chaitanya. Both are leaders of the pure devotees. Pure devotees of the Lord have no desire other than the service of the Lord, and therefore they are called sattvata. The Lord is the chief amongst such sattvatas. Bhishma Dev, therefore, had no other desires. Unless one is purified from all sorts of material desires, the Lord does not become one's leader. Desires cannot be wiped out, but they have only to be purified. It is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita by the Lord himself that he gives his instruction from within the heart of a pure devotee who is constantly engaged in the service of the Lord. Such instruction is given not for any material purpose, but only for going back home, back to Godhead. For the ordinary man who wants to lord it over material nature, the Lord not only sanctions and becomes a witness of activities, but he never gives the non-devotee instructions for going back to Godhead. That is the difference in dealings by the Lord with different living beings. Both the devotee and the non-devotee, he is the leader of all living beings, and as the king of the state rules both the prisoners and the free citizens. But his dealings are different in terms of devotee and non-devotee. Non-devotees never care to take any instruction from the Lord, and therefore the Lord is silent in their case. Although he witnesses all their activities and awards them the necessary results, good or bad, the devotees are above this material goodness and badness. They are progressive on the path of transcendence, and therefore they have no desire for anything material. The devotee also knows Sri Krishna as the original Narayan, because Lord Sri Krishna, by his plenary portion, appears as the Karanadakshayi Vishnu, the original source of all material creation. The Lord also desires the association of his pure devotees, and for them only the Lord descends on the earth and enlivens them. The Lord appears out of his own will. He is not forced by the conditions of material nature. He is therefore described here as Vibhu, or the Almighty, for he is never conditioned by the laws of material nature. Om Agyantimidandasya Gyananjana Chalakaya Chakshurum Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padatama Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajataham Sahagana Raghunathan Vidham Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Radhika Sri Vishakam Vidhamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Sindubhya Evacha Patithanam Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna I'm very grateful to be among all of you today. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to serve you. We are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 9, entitled The Passing Away of Bhishma Dev. Text 32. Bhishma Dev said, "Let me now invest my thinking, feeling, and willing, which were so long engaged in different subjects and occupational duties, in the all-powerful Lord Sri Krishna. He is always self-satisfied, but sometimes, being the leader of the devotees, he enjoys transcendental pleasure by descending on the material world, although from him only the material world is created." In this chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, the very essence of Mahabharata and all the great Vedic literatures is being revealed to us. Vedaish to Saravir Aham Eva Vedyo Vedanta Krit Veda Vedevaja. Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita that he's the compiler of the Vedas, he's the knower of Vedanta. And by all the Vedas is he to be known. Yat karoshi rashnasi yaj johoshi dasya. That whatever we do ultimately should be done as an offering to the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, Suta Goswami and the sages of Naimasharanya, in their preliminary discussions, spoke that beautiful verse, Atapumbir dvijastrestas varna shrama vibhagasha shvanushtatasya dharmasya samsadira haritosha. Whatever our position in society, whether we're family or renunciates, whatever our occupation, whether we're learned priests, administrators, warriors, doing business, agriculture, laborers, the success of our efforts is simply to the extent we please Krishna. Ultimately, nothing else matters. People strive so hard in this world to get some results. It may be fame, maybe good health, maybe wealth, power, influence over others. It may be creating beautiful art or poetry or architecture, something that we think for generations to come people will remember us. But according to Srimad Bhagavatam, all these goals are just distractions. But Maya, material energy, is expert at presenting just the perfect, appropriate attraction and distraction for each and every one of us. Maybe the form of a beautiful person or a beautiful thing. Maybe the form of victory, kingdom. But the scriptures, through the histories, through the examples, and through the philosophies, are telling us that essentially there's only one thing that matters. Is Krishna pleased? Is God happy with what we've done? The association of devotees is crucial to keep us focused on that only real goal of life. Nothing else can bring us real happiness. Everything else distracts us from real happiness. But we become so allured. There's just so many temporary, flickering alternatives that come in our life. Abrahma bhuvana loka punaravartunojana. When we see from Krishna's perspective, even those results that may last for millions of years are just flickering distractions. Even the attainment of the position of Brahma, who rules over the entire universe for 311 trillion years, is just a flickering distraction. From the perspective of the eternal soul, these are like just little tiny sharpened pencil points on a line that extends to eternity. And we have to be reminded of it. Nastu prayeshu bhadreshu nityam bhagavati sevaya. It's important that we discuss these teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam on a regular basis. Otherwise, whoever we are, we will be distracted. Maya dyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam. Because this material energy is Krishna's external energy. He has his antaranga and bahiranga shakti. And we're tatashta shakti. We're going to be influenced by either his higher or lower energies. And when we, by our own free will, put ourselves under this illusory energy, It's beyond our powers. We are insignificant before the power of Maya. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada would say, the problem with you Western devotees is you are not enough afraid of the powers of Maya. And for you Indians in the UK, he's talking to you as much. And these days, even in India, it really doesn't make any difference. With the help of television and satellites and technology, nobody's properly afraid of the powers of Maya anymore. Afraid doesn't mean we live in fear. It means we take it very seriously. Just like mosquitoes. How many of you are afraid of mosquitoes? I wasn't so afraid until I got malaria. Yes, I remember Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj was in Africa. I was in India. And all around us, people were getting malaria, but we never got malaria. So whenever we would meet in Washington, D.C. or someplace, we would, in the course of our hours and hours of discussion every year, we would always proclaim that still I never got malaria. And he never got malaria. And we were kind of getting a little proud of the fact that we never got malaria. And then when I went back to India, I got malaria. It was devastating. Even medicines. I took medicines and they just come out. I'm not going to be too graphic on that. So I had to get intravenous and go to the hospital. And then when I came back, I realized I couldn't continue this thread of conversation we had. And he said to me that he got malaria. And the amazing thing, when we exchanged notes, we both got malaria on the same day. He was in Africa, I was in India. And we both had to go to the hospital because the medicine was coming out. And we couldn't calculate too many details, but it seemed like we got bit by the same mosquito. But anyways, after that, I started sleeping with a mosquito net, something I never did before. It wasn't that I was living in fear of mosquitoes, but I had some realization of what they can do and took precautions. So in the same way, Maya Devi, she's everywhere. She's flying around, inside of us, outside of us. And fear of Maya means understanding her powers and understanding how we really need to take shelter. The net against Maya. Daivi Heshugunamayu. Mama Maya Duratyaya, Krishna tells. The only net to protect us of Maya is to take shelter of him. Neither our strength, our intellect, how many followers we may have, how much money we have, how much charity we give, none of these things can protect us from Maya. Only taking shelter of Krishna. Because he gives shelter to those who seek it. So when we know the powers of Maya, and we know our own vulnerability, we become humble. Because you cannot take shelter of God without a humble heart. Taking shelter without real humility is an external exercise. a real taking shelter of Krishna. Srila Prabhupada used the example, when we take shelter of Krishna through chanting his name, it is required we become like an infant baby in danger, crying for the mother. Spontaneously, with innocent faith. A little baby just has an innocent faith that whatever is there, my mother will be there to help me. And this is how a devotee is striving to come to Krishna. Little Prahlad, Dhruva, they were children. But whatever may have happened after they attained that state, they were fearless. Pajahure mana srinandanandana abhaya charanada vindare. When we sincerely take shelter of Krishna, srinandanandana, we become fearless. But it's interesting, Prabhupada says, you have to learn how to fear in order to become fearless. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense. But it makes sense. Because this is the inconceivable philosophy of bhakti. When we understand the power of the fearful forms of illusion, we take shelter of Krishna and we become fearless. A devotee's fear is to forget Krishna. And especially in the growing stages of Krishna consciousness, when we become afraid of forgetting Krishna, then we take very seriously the processes, the association, and the attitude that helps us to remember Krishna. All the scriptures, it is said, they all culminate in two instructions. To always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. When Krishna appears in this world, through his devotees, he teaches us how to do so. Today we're reading the story of Bhishma. Here, the culmination of all of his realizations and his entire inconceivable, complex life are being revealed. He was extremely dutiful, extremely misunderstood. Apparently, he even made some serious mistakes. But ultimately, his realization is his thinking, feeling, and willing was being surrendered to Krishna, who descends to this world, apparently like a human being, although he's the creator, maintainer, and destroyer of the entire existence. Srila Prabhupada writes in one purport that Bhishma Dev, he took the side of the demons. Why? And so many philosophers and historians and speculators have given their opinions. And Vyasadeva explains through the Vedas the same stories from different perspectives according to people at different levels of consciousness. The Mahabharata mainly deals with Artha Kama Dhamma Moksha, approaching God, approaching religion for economic development, sense gratification, religiosity, liberation. There are so many moral instructions, so many amazing histories that teach us so many different lessons. But the culmination is the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita culminates Sarva Dharman Puritya Jamam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo Moksha Ishami Masuja. Abandon all varieties of Dharma and just surrender to me. Man Manabhava Mad Bhakto Madhyajinnan Namaskuru. Always think of me. Become my devotee. Worship me. Offer your homage to me. In this way you will come to me without fail. Because you are my friend. Surata Sarva Bhutanam. Krishna is the ever well-wishing friend of all living beings. Srimad Bhagavatam tells the same stories from the perspective of pure devotional service. Dharma Prochita Kaitavatra. The beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna, or Vyasadeva tells us that from the very beginning, this scripture, the Bhagavad Purana, is putting aside all Kaitava Dharma. All religious principles, spiritual principles that do not bring us to the ultimate goal. Sabai pungsang paro dharmo yato bhaktir dhokshate. Ahoitaki apratihata yayatma suprasidati. The supreme dharma for all humanity is that which brings us to that point of loving service to the one supreme personality of Godhead. That loving service must be unmotivated by selfishness, by egoism, and uninterrupted by any circumstance in order to satisfy the self. And we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam, when you water the root of the tree, naturally that water extends to every part of the tree. When we satisfy Krishna, we satisfy our own self. And to the degree we have no real concern for satisfying our own self, our self is satisfied. This is incredible concept. In Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, in his explanation of the identity of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is telling like this. He's explaining the nature of the love of the gopis of Vrindavan. They care nothing about their own happiness or distress, their own safety or danger. They're only concerned with pleasing Krishna. They're willing to go to hell for countless years, if they could give Krishna a moment of pleasure. And because they have no desire for their own satisfaction, only Krishna's satisfaction, Krishna reciprocates by giving them the ultimate satisfaction. If you want it, you don't get it. If you don't want it, you get it. This is spiritual psychology. Of course, in the beginning stages, we may want it, but at least we understand that in order to get it, I have to go beyond wanting it. That's love. Real love is the complete commitment to the satisfaction of the object of our love. Krishna is the Vishai Vigraha. He's the supreme object of love. Sri Radha is the Ashray Vigraha. She's the supreme abode of love. And her entire existence for all eternity, being Krishna's pleasure potency, is giving pleasure to Krishna. she doesn't even consider her own desires. And her expansions, the gopis, they are all there to just assist her in giving pleasure to Krishna. They have the same consciousness in the sense, parts and parcels of her consciousness of giving pleasure to Krishna. And because they have no desire for themselves, Krishna is so conquered by that love, being the Supreme Person, that he reciprocates by giving them his own love to the extent that Krishna feels that Sri Radha and gopis are more happy than him. How is this possible? He's the supreme source of all happiness. And yet he's not just thinking, feeling, he's understanding. He's the knower of everything. He knows every living being. He knows past, he knows present, he knows future. But there's one thing I don't know. What is that happiness that they experience when they taste my love? What is the nature of their love? It's greater than mine. Krishna sees a reflection of himself on a jeweled pillar. And he's so attracted to his own beauty. He's actually mesmerized by his own beauty. But he's thinking, but I can't really appreciate it. Only Sri Radha and gopis can really appreciate it. What do they experience? That's what I want. And that is the philosophical explanation in Chaitanya Charitamrita of why Krishna accepts the complexion and the loving mood of Sri Radha as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And out of supreme compassion for all living beings, he wants to share that love with the world. In the age of Kali, the age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the age of so much suffering, the age where it's so difficult to live with integrity, morality, and true spiritual principles, and there's so much confusion of what the goal of life really is, and no matter what you do, there's so many arguments and debates about what it really should be. But in this age, Krishna wants to share Sri Radha's, he wants to taste Radha's love and distribute Radha's love through the simple process of remembering him and serving him and pleasing him by chanting his holy names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. But even as devotees, so many complications come in our lives, because that's the nature of this world. But what's important is, as a community of Vaishnavas, we have to help each other to keep focused on what the real goal is. And Srimad Bhagavatam is telling the real goal is unconditional loving service to the Lord. When we actually rise above our own attachments to happiness, distress, pleasure, pain, honor, dishonor, success and failure, and fix our minds on what pleases Krishna. In Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopa Kumar goes back to Godhead and meets Krishna, Krishna embraces him and expresses his very personal appreciation. Krishna understands what it's like living in this material world and struggling through it all. He's created it. that you have undergone so many difficulties for my sake, so many tribulations for my sake, so many complications, and you pass through all of it with the desire to please me. And I was right there, seeing it all, feeling it all. And I'm so indebted to you for your devotion. Welcome home. When Hanuman jumped across the Indian Ocean, and so many obstacles came in his path, inconceivable, incomprehensible obstacles, giant rakshashis and huge golden mountains. But Hanuman, he didn't think about his own rest. He didn't think about his own fame. He was just thinking, what will please Ram is to get this message to Sita. And when he was in Sri Lanka, this one little monkey and the entire massive Rakshasa armies were there against him. But he didn't think about himself. What will please Sita is what will please Ram. And when he finally came back after performing a service that for millions and millions of years we're still singing about, Ram said, I have no way to repay you. All the risks, all the difficulties you endured for me, how can I repay you? I'm living in a cave on top of a mountain. I've been exiled from my kingdom. I have no wealth. I have no positions to give you. All I have is myself. I give you myself. And with those words, Ram embraced Hanuman, as Krishna embraced Gopakumar. And that's all Hanuman wanted. He pleased Ram. Sansidhir Hari Toshino. Srila Prabhupada, his example. He also crossed oceans like Hanuman. He crossed two oceans. And, you know, Hanuman could fly. I had to take cargo ship. Even more difficult. He crossed those oceans. He endured so many obstacles on the way. Hanuman, there was Simika and Surasa, and there was that big mountain, and then Lankini, and Srila Prabhupada. The same principle, but something that very much we could relate to. We should be able to relate to Hanuman. But, you know, we just can't jump over oceans and fight the greatest of the Rakshasas and just beat them down with a stick and burn the city of Lanka with our tails. But the principle of selfless, pure devotion. Srila Prabhupada was given the same kind of obstacles that we could really personally identify with. Heart attacks, being alone with just Krishna in his heart, poverty, so many obstacles. But he explained in his prayers and in many of his talks, he just wanted to please his spiritual master. That's all. His guru asked him to do it, and he was just trying to please his guru. Ram asked Hanuman to get this message across, and he did it. Srila Prabhupada was coming to rescue Sita, the embodiment of devotion, from all of our hearts, which have been usurped by the Ravana of our own greed and envy and egoism, with the simple message. the message of pure devotional service. So these examples show us practically how we can actually please Krishna. And in pleasing Krishna, Krishna is so indebted. Incredible. This is one of the great opulences of Krishna. Why would the sun planet be indebted to a single little tiny sun ray? Does that make sense? Does the sun planet say to a... How many sun rays are there? And how big are they? And they're all emanating from the sun. And whatever light the sun ray has, and whatever heat is coming from the sun. So what does the sun ray have to offer to the sun? That's our relation with Krishna. Mamaivam so jivaloki jivabhuta sanatana. But yet, with the light and the heat, with the energies that we have, if we just utilize them for the pleasure of Krishna, Krishna's indebted to us. That's Rasa Vihari. He's the supreme, ultimate reciprocator of love. He's not just saying it, he's feeling it. These babies are keeping us reminded of how we should cry out for Krishna. And if we can just cry like that baby for Krishna and offer our hearts to Krishna. Krishna told the gopis, what did they do? From a social perspective, it was just, they left home one night when Krishna played his flute. And they ran into the forest for Krishna. They didn't care about their social position. They didn't care about the dangers of rejection that may have been in store for them. They just wanted to please Krishna. And Krishna, who gives them all the strength to do these things, and who attracted them with his own beauty and sweetness, he said, even in a lifetime of Brahma, I could never repay you for your devotion. I am forever indebted to you. This is bhakti. This is the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. That by pleasing Krishna, out of love, we're not concerned that we become happy, but Krishna reciprocates by giving us the ultimate happiness. And Srila Prabhupada explains in many different instances in the Nectar of Devotion, Krishna's servant is fanning Krishna. And seeing Krishna's beauty, Krishna's revealing himself in such a way, and so much love is erupting in his heart, the tears are coming from his eyes. And he's praying for the ecstasies to go away. Because this ecstasy I'm feeling is blocking my view of Krishna, so I can't fan him properly. Let the ecstasies go away so I could give Krishna ecstasy. That is pure devotional service. Bhishma Dev, why did he take the side of the Kurus? So many explanations are there. And from different perspectives, each one of them is correct. Some say because he was loyal. He was loyal to the throne. And Duryodhana was the king. And it was his duty to show the example for all time to come that we must be loyal to the King. Hare Krishna. Yadyaracharatistrestastatarevitarojana. What great people do, common people follow. So he was showing lessons from many, many different perspectives. We can briefly go a little into the life of Bhishma, but it's impossible to do it briefly. But we'll try. It was Santanu Maharaj. He had... These are inconceivable leelas of the Lord that were meant to open the doors to even greater inconceivable leelas of the Lord. So Maharaj Santanu, he fell in love with Ganga, the personified goddess of the Ganges. And he wanted to marry her. And she was happy to marry him. Now, I haven't read these stories in a long time, but I'm going to try to tell them anyway. So correct me if I make any mistakes, please. And Mother Ganga told him that I will accept two conditions. One, never question anything I ever do. Now, any of you husbands out there? I'm a Swami, so I don't have any direct experience with this. But I do see a lot of stuff. And I do hear a lot of things. And it sounds pretty difficult. Never, ever question anything I do. And if you do question, I will leave immediately. So as the king, he wanted to have children, especially someone who will take over the throne. It's one of the greatest duties of a king is to have a child who you really raise and groom to be a representative of God for the people. In Ramayana, we read about Dasarath Maharaj. Everything was so auspicious in Ayodhya. He had conquered all his rivals. Every single one of his citizens practically loved him like they loved their own father, and Kausalya like mother. He had obedience. There was prosperity. There was no economic difficulties like in the world today. There was no unemployment. There was no political priorities trying to tear him down. Everything was just perfect, except he didn't have a son who could take over after him. So Santanu, for him, this was something very, very sacred and very important. And finally, he had a son. Can you imagine how happy he was? Now, when some of you have a son, you're really happy. Or a daughter, you're really happy. But he wasn't just happy for himself and his family. He was happy because it was pleasing to God, to Krishna, and to the whole world. Because that child was an offering to Krishna and for the whole future of society. And as soon as the child was born, Ganga Devi just walked with the child, and Santanu followed. What's she doing? Because it's not normal that after you give birth, you just walk away with the child. And she went to the river, Ganga, and threw the child in the Ganga, and it went underwater. And she just watched it drown. Can you imagine? but he couldn't say anything. He couldn't ask, why did you do that? Because he knew she would leave. And then one child after another, after another, after another, she did the exact same thing. And how many was there? Eight? Seven. And the seventh child. It was becoming really traumatic. And she just did it totally indifferent. It's not like she was a terrorist or anything. She just... It appeared she was doing it with motherly love. Yes? She was doing it with motherly love. But he couldn't understand. So finally, when the seventh was... She went and was just about to just toss. And by this time, Santanu just couldn't bear it anymore. He said, why are you doing this? And she came and she explained. We can't always understand what great souls do. Sometimes they have a higher purpose behind the apparent activities. So these seven Basus are great, great, great personalities in the heavenly worlds. And they made a mistake. And they were cursed by Vasishtha Muni to take birth in the earth planet. But they didn't want to take birth in this earth planet where there's so many miseries and so many confusions and so much politics and so much envy and all of that. Egoism. They approached Ganga Devi and said, when we take birth from you, promise us that immediately after birth, you will throw us in the Ganga so that we can go right back to the heavenly planets. Then we fulfill the purpose of the curse. We take birth, but we can come right back. So that was, she said she would do that. So she was actually doing what they wanted. She was doing it out of love. She was doing it out of compassion. Because she was seeing who they were beyond just this external little body. She was seeing their souls, their subtle bodies, and their real desires. She was just carrying out their wish. But that seventh of the Basus, who was the leader among all of them, who was empowered with all of the wisdom and all of the strength of all the Basus, she said, unfortunately for him, he has to stay in this world because of you, because you questioned me. So you want this child so much, you can have him. But I'm leaving forever. But she agreed to take the child to the heavenly worlds because he was obviously supposed to be the next king according to Santanu's conception. But she was going to take him to the heavenly worlds to learn every art and science from the greatest authorities. From people like Surya and others, he would learn the scriptures. He would learn the arts. He would learn psychologies. He would learn all the different fighting techniques from Parasuram, the incarnation of Vishnu. He was quite a teacher to have. And after some time, the boy whose name was Devavrata was brought back by Ganga. And he was the crest jewel of any leader, groomed to be the ruler of the world, compassionate, full of wisdom, full of devotion, and unconquerable in his powers. So as he was growing up, and King Santanu was just so proud of him in every way, the king happened to see on the river Satyavati. She was very beautiful, so beautiful, and she had such a fragrance that just, it wasn't perfume from France or anything. It was her body emanated a fragrance that was totally intoxicating. Can you imagine? Don't try to imagine. Just hear and learn. It was Krishna's will, ultimately, that his heart wanted so much her. So he went to her father, who was a fisherman, and proposed. And father said, because he knows how royalty is, you in England probably have more experience than most places in the world. The types of things that go behind the scenes. So he understood that his grandchild, you know, could very much be discriminated against, could be very troublesome. So the only condition that you can marry my daughter is if her son becomes the king. Now this was impossible, because Bhishma was the eldest son. He was groomed to be the king. And Santanu loved Bhishma. So he just felt this is impossible. So he left. But he was feeling very brokenhearted. And Bhishma saw, his name was Devavrata then. Devavrata, what is happening? Why is my father looking so preoccupied? And he asked the chariot driver, and the chariot driver told the whole story. So Devavrata went to Satyavati's father and said, I promise you, I will not take the throne. Your grandson will be the king. The fisherman said, that's not good enough for me. Even if you don't take the throne, if you have a child, that child will have priority over the throne to anyone else. So Devavrata said, I vow before God, before the devas, I vow that I will never marry and I will be purely celibate as long as I live. When he took that vow, the demigods, they were so shocked with awe that they showered flowers on him. And they cried out, Bhishma, 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 which means one who has taken the most terrible vow. And in those days, people believed what you said. You know, today, truthfulness is something that's very conditional upon our convenience. But in those days, an honorable person would live and die to sustain the word of honor. And the fisherman had complete faith that Bhishma would live and die and keep his word. So when Satyavati was coming back to marry Santanu, how is this possible? And he was told what Bhishma did for him. This was the loyalty of Bhishma. Because in one sense, politically, the king is like a representative of God. From a family perspective, the mother and the father are representing God, if they do properly. Bhishma had that consciousness. Santanu was so overwhelmed. By his powers, he gave Bhishma the benediction. He could never be killed. He would only die by his own free will when and where he decided to do so. So they lived. And Santanu had two children, Chitrangada and Vichitravirya. Chitrangada was supposed to be the next king. But somehow he got in a fight with a Gandharva and was killed. And then Vitruchavirya. And he became very ill in due course of time and died. And they had no children. So this was a dilemma. Meanwhile, Bhishma was actually the person who was taking care of. He was ruling the whole kingdom without being the king. He was performing his duty without any of the personal benefits of doing it. So duty-bound. Because the children were too young, and then when they grew up, you know, he wanted to just give it to them. But when they died, there was a serious problem. They wanted to keep this divine descendancy of great personalities, the gurus. It was the will of Krishna. So, it's a long story. But Satyavati asked Bhishma to have a child through Ambika or Ambalika, who were the royal queens, princesses. And Bhishma said, I've made my vow. Satyavati said, but this is an emergency. You know, you could make exceptions in emergencies. Bhishma said, as long as there's light in the sun, as long as there's moisture in the water, as long as the stars are shining in the sky, I will not break my vow. And even if the sun burns out and the skies fall from the sky and all the rivers and oceans dry up, still I will not break my vow. He was really a brahmachari. So much difficulty. Then Satyavati had to reveal a secret that practically no one knew. Do you all know it? You know it. But in Harikatha, even if we speak the secret hundreds of millions of times, it's still a secret. I'm about to tell you something that hundreds of millions of people have heard, that all of you have probably heard throughout your lives, but it's a top secret that nobody knows. She explained when she was young how she got this beauty and how she got this fragrance, how she got the blessings of her life. One of the greatest of the yogi rishi sages, Parasara Muni. Great Vaishnav too. He's the speaker of the Vishnu Purana. When Sripad Yamunacharya had just passed away from the world physically, Ramanujacharya had come just after he had already passed from the world. And they were about to perform the last rites. And they saw as he was laying there, his body, it was something that they never saw before in him. It was Kanchipurnam and Mahapurna and all these great disciples, Gostipurna of Yamunacharya, who were with him for so many years. But three of his fingers were folded up. Why is he like that? They were all questioning. And Ramanujacharya, he understood the heart of his guru. And he spoke. He said, I will write a Vaishnav commentary according to the principles of the Sri Sampradaya to the Vedanta Sutra. And one of the fingers opened. He said, I will spread the message of pure, unalloyed devotional service throughout the land. The other finger open. And he said, because you are such a great devotee of the Vishnu Purana, I will name a disciple after the speaker of that Purana, Parasara. And the other finger opened. And everybody understood he knows the heart of our guru. And they made him the successor acharya. So Parasara Muni, Parasara is very, very great personality. Even though Krishna, we cannot imitate great souls. Mahajano Yena Gatasa Panta, Ramanuja and all of these great sannyasis, they worship and honor Parasara Muni. But Krishna, Krishna engaged him in very transcendental pastimes. Parasara wanted to bring a child into the world through Satyavati. And he convinced her. Nobody will ever even know. It will happen instantly, and you'll remain a perfectly pure virgin. So we can't imitate that. What to speak of give birth to Vyasadeva, the literary incarnation of Krishna, the compiler of the Vedas. So Vyasadeva was born, and he just went up to the Himalayas and performed tapasya, became the greatest of all rishis. In fact, this is called the Vyasasana. Vyasasana means whoever speaking from the Bhagavad Gita, speaking from Srimad Bhagavatam, our qualification is just that we're sitting on the seat of Vyas. It's humbling. At least it's supposed to be. It means it's not about me. We don't take any credit for whatever we can do to enlighten other people. We're just repeating the words of Parampara, which is coming through Vyasadeva, who has given us the Vedas, who has given us the example. Madhvacharya and our sampradaya went all the way to Adi Badri. How many of you have been to Badrinath? Please raise your hand. It's way high in the Himalayas. But that's where we can go to. The Alaknanda River is flowing. And there's the Badri Gashram temple, Badri Vishal. Sripad Madhvacharya went there, but he wanted to personally meet Vyasadeva. So he walked to Adi Badri, which is so high in the peaks of Himalayas that no human could ever get there. But he's son of Vayu, so he could do things that nobody else could do. So he was walking really fast, and some of his disciples tried to follow him. And he said, better you don't. No, we have to be here to serve you, Guru Maharaj. But as he was walking through all these snow and under Himalayas, and they were like completely exhausted. So out of his causeless mercy, he went, and they flew back to Badrinath, the place where they started from. And he went all that way just to meet Vyasadeva and receive instruction from him. Receive some Shalagram Shilas from him. Receive this is Vyasadeva. So he was living in Himalayas. The son of Satyavati and Parasara. And she said, Bhishma, if you're not willing to do my other son. What? You have another son? Yes. Vedavyas. Everyone knew the exalted position. So she called for him. And he's up in caves of Himalayas performing tapasya. So he's a real rishi. And he came down And he wasn't like a prince or a king, and he didn't have that type of royal beauty. He was an ascetic. So it was an emergency situation for the sake of the world, for the service of Krishna. And Ambika, when she saw him, she closed her eyes because she wasn't accustomed to this type of person to be so close. So Vyasadeva knows past, present, and future. He came out of the room. Satyavati, Bhishma were all, please tell us what will happen. He said, this person will be very powerful, full of intelligence and wisdom, but because she closed her eyes, he'll be blind. So this was a disqualification. So they asked him with Ambalika. So Vyasadeva, for the welfare of the whole universe, he came out. They said, what will happen? What will happen? He said, he started explaining all the incredible attributes. He said, but because of my appearance, she became very pale and white. So this child will be very pale, white, and sickly. So later on, they asked, we need a good king. So Ambika, for her, once was enough. So she secretly put her jewels and her clothes on her maidservant. And Vedavyas came and said, this child will be the very embodiment of Dharma. He will have every good quality. But, just for your information, his mother's a maidservant. So Dhritarashtra was born blind, Pandu was born pale, and Vidura was not entitled to the throne according to the conventions of those days. Pandu became king. And eventually, a whole series of situations happened when he was in the forest with Kunti and Madri. And he had 5 children, the Pandavas. Due to Kunti's blessings, Durvasa Muni, she could call upon any demigod. When she was young, in a similar way, by inconceivable arrangement of destiny, she just looked at the sun and called out the name of the sun god, and the sun god gave her Radheya or Karna as a child. Then with Pandu, he told her call because he was not able to do so himself, and she had Yudhisthira from Dharmaraj, Yamaraj, from Vayu, Bhima, and from Indra. Arjun was born. And through Madri Nakula Sahadev. So they were living in the forest, and in a very untimely, unfortunate way, Pandu died. So the 5 Pandavas were brought under the protection of Dhritarashtra. And everyone knew he was only supposed to be a caretaker of the throne until Yudhisthira came to age. Meanwhile, Dhritarashtra with his wife Gandhari had 100 children. The eldest Duryodhana, who was the very personification of envy. He couldn't tolerate that someone else would take the throne. And even though Dhritarashtra was an amazing, incredible personality, due to his attachment to Duryodhana, he lost all of his good principles. And as the Pandavas were growing, Dhritarashtra was convinced by his son and his associates to do everything they can to murder the Pandavas. But Krishna was always there to protect them. And Bhishma, he was seeing all this happening year after year after year. It was Bhishma and Vidura who were always giving good advice to Dhritarashtra. But due to this bad association, attachment to these egoistic conceptions of I and mine, Dhritarashtra, he knew what Vidura was saying was right. He knew that Bhishma's wisdom was correct. Even Drona was chastising him. But he always listened to his son. They tried to burn the Pandavas and Kunti alive. They tried to poison Bhima. They cheated them and exiled them for 12 years. 13th year had to be completely incognito, otherwise another 12 years. They tried to embarrass them. They were constantly spreading the most vicious lies against the Pandavas, so the citizens would never have any faith in them. They were thorough in every way. Duryodhana was really an empowered, expert person. But unfortunately, Krishna doesn't see what we do. He sees our purpose. He was motivated by envy. Bhishma, at a certain point, when there was a great, after the Pandavas and the Kurus, they graduated from Dronacharya's Academy for Martial Arts. There was a big tournament, and Arjuna was winning like anything. And suddenly this very mysterious, unknown person came in. And as soon as he walked in, Kunti fainted. Nobody knew who he was. He was Karna, Kunti's first son. When Bhishma saw that, he didn't need an explanation. He had such intuition. He had such sensitivity. He understood, this is Kunti's son. And Karna immediately became the worst enemy with Arjuna, although they didn't know that they were brothers. And he joined the sides of Duryodhana, and years and years of this hate and anguish and espionage and crookedness, everything was happening. Bhishma was watching it all, trying to make a difference, trying to change it. But still, he honored the seat of Dhritarashtra that he gave him, because it was rightfully his at the time. And even though he exploited from Yudhisthira, at the time of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Bhishma chose to be the commander-in-chief of Duryodhana's army against the Pandavas. Why? And Duryodhana, he was completely convinced that he was going to win because Bhishma was undefeatable. In the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Duryodhana is calculating, you know, who's on each side. Pandavas may have these people, but I have Bhishma. With Bhishma, Bhishma alone. During the war, when Duryodhana incited Bhishma to become angry, he exterminated in one day practically half of the Pandavas' army. And Yudhisthira was really forsaken because nobody could stand before Bhishma. It's like if there's a massive hurricane You know, are you going to shoot a bullet at it? I'm going to shoot an arrow. When there's a massive hurricane, all you could do is get out of the way or just stand and watch. That's the way Bhishma would fight. Neither Bhima or Juna or Yudhisthira, Drishtadyumna, nobody. He was just like so empowered. He destroyed half of us. Tomorrow he's going to destroy the other half. What are we going to do? And Krishna knew Bhishma's heart. He said, there's only one thing that we can do. Tonight, when everyone's resting, we incognito go to his tent. And Yudhisthira Maharaj, Bhima, Arjuna, you have to ask him permission to kill him. And you have to ask him how to kill him. Because he has a benediction that he can never be killed, he can never be defeated. So how do you kill somebody who... The only way is you have to get his permission, and he has to tell you how to do it, and he has to want to do it. So this is never seen before in the history of military chivalry. But Krishna said it, and they had total faith in Krishna. But the beauty of Mahabharata is the depths behind the scenes of these devotees' hearts. Yudhisthira, Bhima, and Arjuna. Even though Bhishma was the commander-in-chief of the enemy army representing Duryodhana, after Krishna, they loved him more than anyone else in the world. Because they understood his heart. He always loved them. He was always trying to protect them. And he did in so many ways. He was their total well-wisher, although he was on the wrong side. How could they ask their own grandfather, in a sense, we want to kill you. Tell us how. They were weeping. Their hearts were broken. We love him. How can we ask him such a question? But it was Krishna's order. So they asked him. And as soon as they asked, tell us how to kill you, for the first time, they never saw this before, Bhishma lit up with ecstasy. He was just waiting, he said, for this moment to come. Because out of duty, who remained on this earth, his brothers, the Vasus, were waiting for him in heavenly planets, where there wasn't all this kind of terrible envy and greed and egoism and espionage. He was meant to go back, but out of duty, in the service of Krishna, he was staying on and tolerating this, and his heart was being broken at every moment seeing the injustices to the Pandavas. He said, this is the happiest moment of my life. I'm going to tell you how to kill me. And it's a long story. But Shikhandi was a girl. But at the same time, now she's a man. Kind of, you know, he was seeing her as both. But Shikhandi was in love with Bhishma. At one time, Satyavati and others, they wanted the best queens for Vichitravirya. So he couldn't actually conquer them in this tournament. So Bhishma came and took them. But was it Amba? She said afterward, she told Satyavati that actually I had already given my heart to another prince. Bhishma, then I can't, then I must take you back. But then the prince said, but you've been touched by this Bhishma, so I cannot take you. So she was in a very, very difficult situation. So she went to Satyavati and said, I have to be a widow because of this Bhishma. So Satyavati said, you should marry her. It's an emergency. Bhishma, I will follow any order that you give me, but I will never break my vow. So she said to this lady, this princess, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. So then she went to Parasvaram, Bhishma's military guru, and told him the situation. He said, I will help you. And he ordered Bhishma, you must marry this girl. Bhishma, he had his mantra. Even if the sun burns out, even if every river and ocean dries up, even if every star falls from the sky, I will never break my vow. Parasaram said, then I will fight with you. And they fought. And Bhishma was such a good fighter that Parasaram couldn't win and Bhishma couldn't win. And they went on for many, many days, fighting, 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 and ultimately, when they both realized neither could win the other, Bhishma humbled himself because he was a student. And Parasaram, these are the way Kshatriyas are. He just congratulated Bhishma. I'm so proud of you because you're so good. And then Parasaram told the girl, I'm sorry, there's nothing. So then she did tapasya to Lord Shiva. And ultimately, Shiva, whatever benediction, he's Ashutosh, I will give you. She said, I want to take birth and I want to kill Bhishma. He gave her the benediction. And she took a Kshatriya body, Shikhandi. Am I correct so far? Any corrections? Okay, you're all so humble and tolerant. I'm amazed. Now, this part of the story is so moving. Bhishma, he was explaining that the reason Shikhandi took that vow to kill him, she was Amba before, yes, is because of her love for him. Because in love, you know the heart of the beloved. There's a certain intuition that comes with true love. She knew that Bhishma, more than anything else, wanted to die. He wanted to be out of this miserable world and go back to his relatives in the heavenly worlds. But he couldn't die except to deny his own will, and as a Kshatriya, he had to defend the principles of his duties. So out of love for me, she knows my real heart. I want to go back to Godhead. So tomorrow in the battlefield, come before me. Put Shikhandi in the front. Because I see him as a her. I can't fight against her. I just have to look away because I'm a brahmachari. He didn't say it exactly like that. I'm rephrasing. But in spirit, he would not look at her or him. He said, let Shikhandi shoot the first arrow. And then the prophecy will be fulfilled, and her desire out of her love will be fulfilled. But no one can penetrate my body except you, Arjuna. With all of your might, shoot your arrows through my body, and I will welcome them. This will be your love for me. They were weeping, crying. The next day in battle, they came before Bhishma. Duryodhana was so happy, because Bhishma, that day, he blew his conch shell like he never blew before. And Duryodhana interpreted it. This means he's going to be victorious today and conquer the Pandavas. But actually, in his heart, he was blowing it with such enthusiasm because he knew he was going to die that day. Not die, but be defeated. So there was a very internal significance that was interpreted in every different way by different people. So Bhishma started destroying everything, like death personified. And then Arjuna and the others put Shikhandi in the front, and Bhishma looked away, and Shikhandi shot an arrow. And Arjuna was shooting. But as he was shooting, he loved his grandfather. He couldn't shoot very hard. His eyes were filled with tears, and he was going, they were kind of going in his body partially. And Bhishma, with great enthusiasm, conviction, and joy, he told Arjuna, shoot with all your power. You have to pierce my entire body. Shoot, shoot. And Arjuna, for the pleasure of Bhishma, went right through his body with every arrow, going in through the front, coming out through the back. And on Bhishma's order, Arjuna shot so many arrows through his body, from his neck to his feet. And there are so many that you could not even put a single finger between two arrows. And then Bhishma, ecstatically, for him, this was his greatest victory. He laid down in the bed of arrows. And because every person on both sides of the army honored him and loved him so much, they stopped the whole battle that day. All the warriors came to offer their tributes to Bhishma. Now, this was in January. If any of you have ever been to Kurukshetra in January, it's very cold outside. He didn't die. Can you imagine? Hundreds and hundreds of arrows through your body, and he was just laying there. All he had to do is just, by his own will, say, okay, Krishna, I'm yours. But he didn't. He sat there in the cold and waited for weeks. Ultimately, by Krishna's grace, the Pandavas were victorious. And when Yudhishthira was coronated as king in Hastinapur, he was so soft-hearted, he was so humble, inconceivable. He felt not joy, but guilt. He felt, because of me, our guru, Drona, was killed. Because of me, so many of our, practically our whole army and the Kuru's army, who were respectable to me, they're all dead. Because of me, there are all these little children who are fatherless. Because of me, there are countless ladies who are now weeping in pain because they're widows. He blamed himself, although he had no fault. It's a great lesson. Because conditioned nature is we want to take credit for what we don't do, and we want to give blame for what we do to others. That's the nature of the ego. But prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasya ahankara vimudatma kartahamiti manyate. Ultimately, Krishna is the doer of everything. To give credit to Krishna is knowledge and honesty. But we want to take credit. We want to be glorified. We want to be praised. A saintly person just wants to see Krishna and every other devotee praised and glorified. That's our happiness. To the degree we find pleasure when we see our Guru and Krishna and Prabhupada and all other Vaishnavas glorified and successful, when we take pleasure in that, that means we're really getting the mercy of Krishna. But when we want it for ourselves, that's a sign of how far we are from real devotion. Yudhisthira Maharaj had that humility, and nobody could pacify him but Krishna. Krishna can do so many incredible things for his devotees simultaneously. He knew that Bhishma, long distance away from Hastinapur, Bhishma was laying in that cold battlefield with countless dead corpses all around him. He was laying there just waiting for Krishna, because he wouldn't die until Krishna came to be standing before him. And Bhishma had total faith that Krishna would come. And he was willing to wait however long it took. Now, we may be performing some tapasya in our life. Sometimes even our sadhana is tapasya. And sometimes we're waiting for quick results. But faith, Rupa Goswami tells that the symptoms of surrender are enthusiasm to perform our service and patience. Patience that I am going to do Krishna's will if it takes a day or a million births, but I know for sure Krishna will come for me. And we never give up. Bhishma laid there. And it was quite painful, just waiting for Krishna. And Krishna wanted to glorify Bhishma. He told Yudhisthira Maharaj that let us go to Kurukshetra. The only person who could pacify you with wisdom and realization is Bhishma. So all the Pandavas went on their chariots with Lord Sri Krishna, and they went to that spot. And they all bowed down before Bhishma. And Bhishma, laying in his bed of arrows, he couldn't, he was already doing like his dandavats backwards. And not a single cell of his body was touching the ground. He was just in the arrows. And because Arjuna didn't shoot his head, Arjuna previously had made a pillow out of arrows for Bhishma. When they all came before him that day when he fell to the ground, Duryodhana came with a beautiful royal pillow to put under his head. And Bhishma said, no, in the battlefield we can accept no luxury. Then Arjuna, understanding his heart, made a pillow out of arrows. He laid it down very happy. In Kurukshetra today, there's a place called Bhishma Kund. It's a very holy place. Bhishma was thirsty. Ganga's his mother. Arjuna shot an arrow in the ground, and from that arrow, Mother Ganga came out of the hole and entered into Bhishma's mouth. And there's a kund where the Ganga appeared for her son. So there, Yudhisthira Maharaj expressed is grief. And Bhishma spoke so many subjects. A major part of Mahabharata is the instructions of Bhishma to Yudhisthira Maharaj. He was so practical. He spoke philosophy, he spoke sociology, he spoke psychology, he spoke military arts, he spoke what to do with spies and what to do with everything is there. And as he was speaking, he saw the sun, Makara Sankranti time, he saw the sun entering into the northern hemisphere. And he understood this is the auspicious time to completely give my heart to Krishna and to pass from the world. And we come to today's verse. But I'm going to go back to the question before addressing today's verse. Why did Bhishma fight for the Kurus? Yes, on one level, it was because he was being faithful to his superior, the king. On another level, it is said, gratitude. Because Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana were playing the role of kings. They were providing everything for him. So when you take from people, you can't just go against them. You're indebted to them. So he was teaching a moral principle. When you receive so much, there should be an indebtedness. You can't betray the people who are helping you, feeding you. But what does that have to do with Sarva Dharman Purityasya? Abandoning all varieties of religion and just surrendering. In Mahabharata, these principles of Dharma, he was exemplifying by remaining faithful to Dhritarashtra. But Srila Prabhupada, in his purport, tells the true secret. Because Bhishma knew Krishna's will. Krishna wanted to show an example to the world. The most important example. That if you are pleasing Krishna, if you are on the side of the will of God, you will be victorious. However many disadvantages may appear materially. And if you are not pleasing the Lord, if you are not representing the will of the Lord, you will be defeated. Doesn't matter who you are. And when Krishna wants to show a lesson, he shows it in the most graphic way. Who else could be a better messenger of this principle than Bhishma? He was the most powerful man on earth. He was, even Parasuram could not defeat him. The Lord's Kshatriya form. And he had a benediction. He could not be defeated or die. And he was in an army that had Drona. And that vastly outnumbered the Pandavas. In a certain way, materially, the Pandavas really didn't have much of a chance in that war. Not against Bhishma. And outnumbered the way they were. But Krishna wanted to show it doesn't matter how intelligent you are. It doesn't matter how strong you are. It doesn't matter how many resources you have. None of this material things really is of any relevance. And Krishna showed it in such a graphic way, as such an example for everyone. It's not that because you're on the side of God that everything's going to go your way according to your expectations. The Pandavas were always surrendered to Krishna. yet they were ridiculed. They were blasphemed of the most terrible propaganda against them. They lost their kings, their kingdom. They were totally humiliated, embarrassed by what Dushasana did to Draupadi. They were exiled to live like fugitives for 13 years. But in the end, this was their glory. They remained faithful. So yes, Krishna wanted to teach the world, however powerful, great you are, by material standards, even to the ultimate extent of Bhishma, you will be defeated. And Bhishma was willing to be misunderstood for the rest of time by common people, because he wanted to be an instrument of Krishna's to show this most graphic message to the world. And when the opportunity came, he was simply blissful. And as the sun was entering into the northern hemisphere, Bhishma stopped all talking about everything else and cast his unblinking glance upon the beauty of Krishna and speaks this verse. Let me now invest my thinking, feeling, and willing, which were so long engaged in different subjects and occupational duties, in the all-powerful Lord Sri Krishna. He is always self-satisfied, but sometimes, being the leader of the devotees, he enjoys transcendental pleasure by descending on the material world, although from him only the material world is created. And according to his own unique Kshatriya service, he's remembering Krishna with such love. His prayers to Krishna are so beautiful, so full of wisdom, and so full of bhav, or love. He's remembering in his prayers how during the battle, Bhishma decided he wanted to glorify Krishna in a very, very incredible way. Because Krishna promised, Kuntiya Pratijanihina me bhakta pranashati, my devotee will never perish. Arjuna, you promised this. Because you are my, you make this promise, you declare it boldly, that my devotee will never perish. Krishna promises, at the same time, Krishna promised he would not raise a weapon and he would not fight. So that's his promise. He's the absolute truth. When the absolute truth makes a promise, it's absolute. Yes? But at the same time, he wanted Arjuna to make a promise that he would protect his devotee. Bhishma, in his heart, he wanted to show Krishna's love for the devotees, for all history. In order to protect Arjuna's promise, I want to show the world how Krishna is willing to break his own promise. So Bhishma fought Arjuna, and no one could compete against Bhishma, not even Arjuna. Arjuna was completely defeated. He was just laying there on the ground, and Bhishma had his arrow and was about, it appeared he was about to kill Arjuna. The only hope for Arjuna is if Krishna broke his promise. And Krishna, Partasarathi, his eyes were red like coals, and he picked up a wheel of a chariot and charged toward Bhishma. Bhishma looked it was the ultimate darshan for Bhishma. If only we could see Radha Gokulananda in this, with this spirit of gratitude and devotion. And he's remembering this in his prayers. Krishna's body was covered with the dust from the hooves of the horses and the wheels of the chariots. And he was so beautiful. His eyes were so angry at Bhishma because he was about to hurt Arjuna. And what Bhishma did, he didn't just have darshan like this. He was a Kshatriya. He was reciprocating. He was shooting arrows at Krishna. And the arrows were piercing Krishna. And our acharyas, Prabhupada quotes Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, that because Bhishma was shooting arrows that were piercing Krishna's body with pure, unmotivated love, Srila Prabhupada writes, Krishna does not see everything we offer to him. Krishna sees the purpose, the intent in which it's offered. Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhakta prayachchati. Whether you offer me a leaf of fruit, a little flower, or water with devotion, I will accept it. And in this case, if you offer piercing arrows in my body with devotion, I will accept it. Krishna was feeling the arrows of Bhishma, just like for when he was feeling the same type of sensation as if a devotee offers fragrant, soft, tender flower petals with love and devotion at Krishna. Now, another analogy that's given, which is kind of hard for me to tell, but I tell it anyway, that if somebody bites you, it's very disturbing, isn't it? But if your lover in love bites you, it feels good. Now, brahmacharis don't meditate on that. Even the grihasthas probably shouldn't meditate on that. But it's a very esoteric conception that if somebody just bites you, it's like, it's an insult. But if your lover bites you because it's with love, it's, oh, it feels so nice. So similarly, because Bhishma was shooting those arrows with love and devotion and gratitude, Krishna was feeling them. He was feeling love. He was feeling ecstasy. Even if he was bleeding, it was ecstatic. And Bhishma was remembering this. For the sake of his devotee, he was willing to break his own promise. That is my Krishna. That was their love. Bhishma was contemplating, how is it that the Pandavas, who were the personifications of religion and dharma, why is it they had to undergo so much sufferings? What to speak of Kunti? Bhishma said, even the greatest thinkers and philosophers cannot understand. It's the power of Krishna in the form of inconceivable time. Krishna always has the most perfect plan for his devotees. But with our little intelligence and minds, it's sometimes inconceivable. Bhishma says, in my opinion, all the sufferings and reversals of the Pandavas, it is all due to inevitable time, under whose control everyone and every planet is carried, just as the clouds are carried by the wind. Oh, how wonderful is the influence of inevitable time. It is irreversible. Otherwise, how can there be reverses in the presence of King Yudhisthira, the son of the demigod controlling religion? Bhima, the great fighter with a club, and the great bowman Arjuna with his mighty weapon Gandiva, and above all the Lord, the direct well-wisher of the Pandavas. O King, no one can know the plan of Lord Sri Krishna, even though great philosophers inquire exhaustively, they are bewildered. I maintain all this is within the plan of the Lord. What this is telling us is the power of faith. When we hear Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, these bhakti scriptures in the association of devotees, Krishna gives us faith. Faith in His love. Faith in the perfection of His mercy. And even if things seem so inconceivable, so apparently illogical to the intelligence of the brain, a devotee is not bewildered because a devotee has faith that Krishna's plan for us is perfect. That faith is the greatest gift. Srila Prabhupada came here to Bhaktivedanta Manor to give us that faith. That if we just chant Hare Krishna and follow these regulative principles and live in a spirit of service and give up the tendency to criticize and engage in all of these selfish activities, whatever may apparently happen to us in our life, Krishna will be there to take us back home, back to God. So now Bhishma is looking up at Krishna, giving his heart, his soul. Krishna, I'm yours. And then he stops speaking. Sharanagati. He demonstrated this pure surrender to the will of Krishna with love. And Krishna reciprocated by coming all the way back to Kurukshetra just to fulfill Bhishma's desire. Bhishma stops speaking. And by his own sweet will, after enshrining the beautiful darshan of Krishna in the very core of his heart, he gave up his life. And the Pandavas and Krishna himself, in separation from him, they had to bow down. Bhishma went back home, back to God. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, at the Siddha Bakula in Puri, Haridas Thakur. He prayed to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I do not want to see the closing pastimes that you are soon to perform. Let my body drop before that day comes. While all the devotees are around, resounding the beautiful sound of your holy names, with your lotus feet pressed to my heart, with my eyes gazing upon your beautiful moon-like face, let my body fall and take my soul. Lord Chaitanya, he said, how will I live without a great devotee like you? Haridasa, why are you making this illusion? There are unlimited devotees of yours fit to sit on my head. If an ant dies, what is the loss to the world? I know you can fulfill my desire. And the next day, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came with his devotees. The same way Krishna came to Kurukshetra with his devotees. different bhava, but the spirit was very much of bhakti. Haridas Thakur took the dust of every devotee's lotus feet. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was glorifying Haridas Thakur's devotion as if he had five mouths. And he induced Swarup Damodar Goswami to sing, and Vakreshwar Pandit to dance, and all the devotees were dancing and singing. Haridas took Lord Chaitanya's beautiful, soft, lotus-like feet and pressed them with his hands to his heart, gazed up at the face of Lord Chaitanya, drinking the nectar of his moon-like beauty, tears flowing from his eyes in ecstatic love. And on his mouth, he was continually chanting, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Sri Krishna Chaitanya. And in front of everyone, by his own sweet will, Haridas gave up his life. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami tells us, at that moment, everyone was remembering the passing of Bhishma. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.